Welcome to the special encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. All this week, we're revisiting our favorite arts and entertainment conversations we've had on the program. Coming up later this hour, our conversation about a photo gallery of protests and demonstrations at Standing Rock. But first, Ike Holter is an award-winning playwright based in Chicago. You may remember a conversation we had earlier this year about one of his works, Hit the Wall. That's a play about the Stonewall Uprisings that was staged in Urbana this January. He's also behind a play at the Goodman Theater in Chicago called Lottery Day. The play's the conclusion to his 7-part Rightland saga, centered on the fictitious 51st Ward of Chicago. It brings back some characters from previous plays that dealt with the historic closings of many Chicago public schools. This play, though, is set around a barbecue in that 51st Ward. I had a chance to sit down with Ike at the Goodman Theater back in March when the play had just opened. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So this is your third play in the last 6 months?
That sounds about right?
When do you sleep?
That sounds about right. I sleep a lot. I go see shows a lot. I go see plays a lot. I think there's people who work 50, 60 hours a week and they get the job done. And I think a lot of people in the arts do that. We just kind of assume that it happens in a shorter time frame. Do you know what I mean? I work as much as my friends who are managers at 7-Eleven or lawyers. So it's like we're all doing the same amount of work. It just looks different.
And so you've produced plays all over the U.S. and all over the world. And I wonder, can we talk about what's different about Chicago theater and doing that here?
I think something that's really cool about Chicago is that the audiences, the people who go to theater, they don't have this kind of pretension of, oh, I'm only going to see shows at large theaters, or I only see like this kind of show. If they hear something's good, they will go to a bar to see it.
Right.
They'll go to a backyard to see it. And they're really unpretentious like that. And, you know, I mean, I've been here for about 16 years now. And that's kind of how I was raised here. It's like, if you hear it's good, go see it. It doesn't matter where it is.
And so it's interesting that you say that because this is the last of a 7-play cycle that you have produced at all kinds of theaters all over Chicago. What about producing, all of them are set in Chicago, even though I guess it's kind of a somewhat fictitious Chicago, or not really?
Yes, it is a very fictitious Chicago. These plays are called the Rightland Saga, so there's 7 of them. Rightland is the 51st Ward. There's 50 wards in Chicago, so we're kind of stretching the idea of what that means. But yeah, they all take place in the same neighborhood. The first one starts in 2011, and this last one, Lottery Day at Goodman, this last one takes place in September 2019. So it kind of spans the decade watching this neighborhood go from thriving to surviving to, when we see it in this play, to something that is unrecognizable from when we first saw it. So it's been completely taken over and gentrified.
And so I know that you probably hate having a question about, is there a theme for all of these plays? But I did read that when someone asked you that once, you said they're often about someone who comes from nothing and then tries to make things better and then ends up becoming what they hated?
Yeah, I think that is a theme that goes throughout it. And I think when we look at what happens in not just neighborhoods in Chicago, especially neighborhoods in Chicago, but all over the U.S., the idea of a bad thing happening is usually traced to a very good person who got lost along the way, who did something wrong. I mean, we see that every day in politics. We see it on a local level. We see it in our schools. So these plays kind of take that into a very small atmosphere where we're not watching like Vader or Thanos run around. We're watching these aldermen. We're watching these people who run small businesses, these car dealers, these people who have a very important part in our city's ecosystem. And we see how the choices they make can actually end up affecting a lot of different people in a lot of different ways.
And so you have an alderwoman who's been in this cycle.
Nina Esposito.
So I wonder how much like life is, I don't know if life is imitating art or other way around, but like when we think about like Alderman Ed Burke, who's been in the news a lot for being investigated.
Yeah.
I wonder how much you think like Chicago politics in itself in real life is kind of like a theater.
I mean, some of the stuff that was in early drafts of that play, Rightland, where the alderman Nina Esposito is, we were working with the dramaturg and we were taking things out. It was like, how far can we stretch this idea? But during the course of us producing that play, during someone would turn on their phone in rehearsal room and say, actually, this thing that we cut, it actually just happened. And it was unbelievable
like
at first. I'm trying to be very delicate here, but I'm just saying that the idea of someone being put in a legal system who is by their own means, a political person incredibly quickly, that is something that we see happen in mafia movies. But seeing it happen in real time is shocking, I think, because, you know, we put these people into power. We think they're going to uphold our interests, especially liberal people. And then we kind of forget about a lot of the bad things until they start to add up. And it's the cycle of, well, now we have to cancel them, but they're already here and we're already benefiting from some of the things that they do. So without putting too fine a point on it, just in the last year, seeing all these politicians fall in similar ways is very dramatic. How about that?
Well, we're talking to Ike Coulter about his drama, which is called Lottery Day, which is opening soon at the Goodman. And so this centers around a party, a cookout, right? Which I think everyone this time of year is especially looking forward to. Can you tell us about the main character, Mallory?
Sure. Mallory is an old school Chicago, black, loud, and proud person who runs this very large house that has served as kind of this family spot for the neighborhood. So we catch up with her when she's basically the last house standing in this gentrified neighborhood. And we get the idea that back in the day, this place was rocking for, like, you know, 24-hour parties. Now she's basically like, this is going to be the end of this moment. And to encapsulate that, we're going to have a party where there will be surprises and possibly money given out. So to these people who are still surviving in this community, hanging on to what they can, the idea of being rewarded for survival is very tempting to a lot of these partygoers who are activists, who are people who are fresh out of their job that's been taken over, people who've lived there in this neighborhood their whole lives. So yeah, Mallory is someone who knows how to be den mother, community mayor, criminal. You know, she's someone who you go to when you need things to happen really quickly. Hmm. And she can also, you know, throw a really good barbecue.
She's really like the precinct captain.
Yes. It's okay. Like you could go to the police or you could go to Mallory, and it would happen a lot quicker with Mallory.
And so when we think about the topic of gentrification, I wonder what your thoughts are and how much you feel like Lottery Day gets into. There's always this juxtaposition, right? Because you want neighborhoods. Everyone talks a lot about neighborhoods in Chicago that are under-resourced and that don't get investment. And then at the same time, when you think about chances for investment, sometimes that you want the neighborhood to grow and you want to have like this economic investment, but then you don't want the people who are there to be pushed out. But that kind of almost seems to happen a lot. And I wonder what you think the play says about if that balance can ever happen.
I think these plays all have different answers to that. I'm very careful without putting my own politics into it, even though people will naturally assume that these plays mirror me, but they, you know, I think the morals of them, like each one has a different kind of moral center, which I like because we're able to talk about this stuff and no one has to feel like the bad guy.
So
like,
what would you say the moral center of Lottery Day is?
I think it is too soon to talk about the moral center of Lottery Day, but I will say that I think the idea of what you just said, neighborhoods needing to change, but also where does that change lead the people who are originally in the neighborhoods. This play tackles that. It tackles the idea of some people wanting the change, even if it means them being pushed out. It also tackles the idea of surviving in a city that doesn't want you, even though you make up the majority of it.
So you have six characters who are coming back in this play who were in previous plays.
Totally.
And I wonder if your characters are kind of like kids. You can't say you have a favorite, but do you?
I don't have a favorite character. I have a favorite show, though. But yes, I don't think the audience will be able to figure that out in this show. But no, you know, it has that kind of Avengers feel of like you've seen this person on a solo journey and then watching them in a very large situation with all these other characters who are old and new. For the people who have been watching this stuff since 2014, it'll be exciting. But for the audience who doesn't know or maybe doesn't care,
there's still about all these war.
yeah it's like, okay, I mean, they're going to introduce themselves in a second and then the plot will go on, and it's not a TV show. This is about something bigger that an audience can just jump onto easily.
And so I wonder how that works in your creative process, like who got to come back, like how did you, were there characters when you were writing the other plays you thought, I want to see what happens more with this person?
Oh, sure. The rule kind of was, because I'd always wanted to write a big old school August Osage County kind of drama about a family, but I wanted to do it with mostly people of color because I usually don't see something like that. So I always had the blueprint for this in my mind, but when I was working on these shows, I was like, I think I can be allowed to take one character and put them into this old scenario. So the idea was to take a character who was not the main focus of an earlier story. So we're not just getting another story with them. It's like one of the characters, Cassandra, who's played by Mackenzie Chin. She is from Sender. She was the smallest part in that show, but now she is an ensemble member here. You learn more about her character. And that's exciting, too. It's not beating these people over the head. They also don't constantly talk about the show that they were in. It's like, oh, I vaguely remember this person from a show I saw 3 years ago. I recognize it's the same actor playing them. That feels awesome. And the audience, I think, is able to watch that in a different way and understand it.
I wonder if it's easier or harder or just different to be working with, so having some actors that you've worked with in the past that are back working with again?
Yeah, I mean, I've never done anything like that. I don't think that happens a lot where it's like, oh, we're doing a sequel.
It's very Joss Whedon, right?
Sure. Oh, totally. Yeah, it's like we can bring you back. But yeah, two of these actors, Reitland, which premiered at Victory Gardens this fall, we had Robert Cornelius in a role there. Now he's back, so he is in this character. Do you know what I mean? We have a really good shorthand because he just got off working the show for 4 months. And then we have an actor like Aurora, who is currently in Red Rex, which is the sixth part, which is playing at Steep right now. So she goes from rehearsal here to doing that show at night. So when she speaks a line, it is as the character, and there's no kind of like, well, what would you think about this? You know, she's like, I know where this is going to go. And she'll come up to me and say, do you honestly think that she would say this in this moment? And you know, it's up to me to be like, well, you're playing her right now. Like, most of your day is spent as this character. So I'm more interested in what they have to say about it. But yeah, it's been a really good organic process to hang out with these actors and keep in touch with them and become very close friends with them. And then years later say, remember that show you did? You're going to have that character. They're going to be aged the appropriate amount of years, and you get another chance at them. And all the actors seem to really enjoy that opportunity to kind of revisit that performance in a new way.
Did you intend that this would be, when you started, did you intend that this would sort of be like a seven plays?
I did the first show in 2014, Exit Strategy, and that was something where I had to create an entire neighborhood, because I think the idea of, I think people are nervous about seeing stuff that takes place in Chicago because they don't want to feel like someone is taking from a community or exploiting a community. I don't see a lot of examples of Chicago in plays. I see a lot of New York shows, a lot of things that take place in London. And we're supposed to, as the audience, be able to understand when they're talking about the Upper West Side. We're supposed to go, oh, I know what that represents, because we were brought up that way. But I think,
well, because we always see it in movies, right?
We always see it in movies. We see so much media about New York City as a character. But if you set something in Chicago, people are like, why are you doing this? What is your motivation? And I think some of it is good to make sure things are being accurately represented. But I also think another component of that is we see Chicago and we think, oh, well, the president talks about this in a certain way. That's a bad place where these mean black and brown people live. So I think anytime that someone puts that in their narrative and has a show that just takes place there or talks about things that we don't usually see there, I actually think that's a pretty powerful political move, because you're saying people live lives here that if you listen to one person, you wouldn't know that. But just like everywhere else, we want to pay the rent. We want to fall in love. We want to do X, Y, and Z. But I think it's really exciting for me as an audience member to see those shows, to see those movies, and hear stuff by people like Chance the Rapper and Common, people who come from here and want it represented in a different way. I'm trying to do that with these shows. I talk to a lot of people, you know, because these shows go other places, and I check out on what people are saying, and there's people having a different conversation about Chicago than I think we're being presented with on a bigger scale, on a national scale.
Mm-hmm. And so I wonder also if people think, as a playwright, and you being a black man, if they think about your identity and think all of your characters need to look like that, what it's like when you inhabit other characters who are not that?
Sure. I mean, yes, I totally understand that. But at the same time, you know, I mean, we don't do that with any white writer or any male white writer. But I think whenever a woman of any color or a person who's not a white man writes something that's not them, people are like, aren't you only supposed to talk about yourselves? I like only see you when it's, you know,
right.
you know, they're used to saying, wait, isn't this unsafe for you? When in reality, it's like I grew up only watching white films and white TV shows because that was all that was on TV. And I also had to, when I was a teenager, get really into bell hooks and Spike Lee and learning about things from a different perspective. So I think a lot of white authors actually know less about white entertainment and other entertainment and queer cinema, et cetera, than we as non-white males have to, because we not only have to keep up with their history, but we have to find our hidden histories.
Is there a particular soundtrack you had that you listened to when you were working on this?
Oh, I love soundtracks. I make one for every show, and I try to make it like sound like the show or feel like the show.
Yeah, so what's your playlist for this?
For this?
For Lottery Day.
This is the biggest one. This has like 50 jams on it. We have everything from Aretha to Mariah to...
Old Mariah or new Mariah?
Well, Mariah died in 1998, so we have the stuff from when she was alive, okay. You know. And I wish we had that Butterfly album, but no one's ever been able to hear that. Who knows what it sounds like? So, yes, we have some NDRE. We have some Chaka Khan. We have some Boyz II Men. We have a lot of black and brown classic people. So, yeah, like, this is a barbecue. It has a feeling of, like, you want slow jams. You want toasty jams. You want some Earth, Wind, and Fire up in there. You want some stuff to balance it out. Maybe you want some 90s stuff. Maybe you want some TLC. Maybe you want some SWV, okay? Maybe you want some SZA. This is a soundtrack that reflects the idea of heightened people in a lowered environment where they can cut back and chill, but there's still, you know, like you still feel the neighborhood through these people.
That was Ike Holter from Chicago's Goodman Theater, director of the play Lottery Day. Welcome back to the special encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
I thought that I actually caused my brother to have cerebral palsy. It was a question that felt very real to me back then. And even as a young adult, I still felt that maybe I was trying to push my way free first in the womb. And I'm ashamed that I have all the abilities and all the strengths that he doesn't have.
That's the voice of photojournalist Chris Capozzello. Chris, his brother Nick, and their family are the subject of the film The Distance Between Us, which explores Nick's cerebral palsy. I spoke with Chris about this back in March when he was on campus as a George A. Miller visiting artist at the University of Illinois. Hi, Chris. Welcome to The 21st.
Thank you, Nyla.
So this film, and there's a book which has photographs that you have made of you and your brother, and photographs your brother has taken as well. Mm-hmm. It's really about your relationship. And you ask some really, really big questions in this book and in this film. I imagine those are questions you've been asking yourself your whole life.
When I was a kid, I asked myself, you know, why is this Nick? Why did it happen to him and not to me? And, you know, these private questions that I didn't share with anybody. I thought, like, my parents knew this. And when the book was published, right before it went to press, I read them the entire thing and showed them the photographs that were going to be in it, which was a nerve-wracking thing because it couldn't be changed at that point. But they didn't know that I had feelings of guilt and anger and, you know, shame for being the healthy twin. And so it was surprising to me that they didn't realize that. But, you know, from a young age, when you grow up next to somebody that has a much different experience in life than you do, then it was heavy. It was very heavy.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot to carry. I wonder if you can tell us just a little bit about Nick. And I think a lot of people have heard of cerebral palsy, but don't know exactly what it is. And then there's lots of different varying ranges and degrees of problems that people have when they have cerebral palsy.
Right. So CP is this umbrella term for a neuromuscular disorder. And it's, you know, there are people on campus, you know, in Dres, you know, that are in a wheelchair. And Nick is very different, has been very different than the people I've met here who have those experiences. For most of his life, he didn't have to use a wheelchair. He does now. And so he's been historically ambulatory. He can have a conversation with you. His cognitive abilities are different. So I sat in on a, we had a panel discussion 2 weeks ago, and there were students that also have twins. And so, you know, these disabled students who have the other, this other experience, Nick is not like them in that way. Nick has these cognitive disabilities and physical disabilities that aren't as severe.
And you have been your career as a photojournalist.
Mm-hmm.
Have you, but did you always, even before you were working as a professional journalist, were you taking pictures of your brother?
So I started making photographs of Nick when I was in college, and we had professors who pushed us and challenged us to photograph things that are around us every day. And that can be a challenging thing, because how do you see the things that are ordinary to you? How do you photograph those things? It's sometimes the experience of going into other people's lives that you're not familiar with, everything is new, and so that's a different experience. And so to photograph what is around you every day can be quite challenging. And so I was trying to find myself, you know, who am I as a photographer? And a professor that I'm very close with challenged me with that. And so when I went home on breaks, I'd have my camera with me. My camera's in the other room right now. And I started photographing my brother. And, you know, I likened it to just practicing. And as I got older, I continued to make pictures of Nick, not with any intention of sharing those pictures, but I just kept photographing him. But then I started photographing him when things were very difficult. So Nick's experience can change. There's like transformative where he will be walking around or hanging out, and then he starts to get a cramp, and so he won't be able to talk.
And they're debilitating. I mean, the amount of pain.
They are, yeah. And it's so his body kind of contorts and locks, like when you have a cramp in your leg, right? But he'll have this cramp for hours, and so he'll get a cramp in his arm, and it'll sort of like curl behind him, and his other arm might curl inward. Sometimes his back will arch with a cramp, and his foot will curl in. Sometimes his other leg will get a cramp. And so, you know, Nick would have to sleep that off. We'd get him in bed, and sometimes that would take just a couple of hours for that to go away. Sometimes it would be days where he'd be in bed. And so I was making photographs, you know, during the fun times, you know, when we're out, you know, at a bar and he's doing karaoke.
Dancing,
yes. There's that one photograph in the book where he's dancing with this woman. And we're in California visiting a friend, and he wanted to dance with somebody. And so my friend's sister asked this woman, "Would you dance with my friend?" And she, you know, this woman, Rachel, thought it was really strange. Just she said no, but as like probably 5 or so minutes later, she walked over and said, "Okay, I'll dance with you." And the funny thing about it is the text that goes along with it, right?
Right, when she says that, "Stop looking at my feet."
Yeah, and then and he tells me this, and later on he recounts, "I wasn't looking at her feet."
Right. We're not going to go into what he was looking at, right?
I didn't ask him. I didn't.
But
you got to let it be sometimes, you know.
How did your family react to you making photographs of the good and the hard times? Was it just kind of just part of life for you guys?
You know, I'd make these pictures and I wouldn't show it to anybody. I didn't show them to Nick. I didn't show it to my parents. So, you know.
Did you look at them?
I did. I looked at them. And, you know, I think in the very beginning, it actually wasn't a healthy thing. At this point, I would say that, you know, the photographs were a cathartic experience, but that didn't come until much later. In the very beginning, I would look at these photographs of my brother in pain, and, you know, it was somewhat masochistic. I would look at these things, and it was like I was inviting more pain for myself. You know, I would be angry that it was him who has such a difficult time in life. And, you know, these feelings of anger and guilt, and the feelings of shame aren't shame. I'm not ashamed of my brother, but I'm ashamed of being that example of what life could have been like for him, because CP is this accident at birth in Nick's situation, and he was supposed to be just like me. He was born and he wasn't breathing, and that changed, you know, our lives forever, and Nick's more so than mine, so.
And when it's your twin, like you write about this in the book, how your teachers would say things like, "Oh, I couldn't tell you guys apart," which would infuriate you.
It still does, yeah. And, you know, there's this idea of, you know, when we talk about race, like, well, I don't see color. And I just think that that's, for me, that's ridiculous.
When it comes to people, their disabilities or abilities.
Exactly. And so, I mean, in terms of race, if I say, well, I don't see color, then I think that I'm denying anybody who's not white like me. I'm denying any sort of difficulties they face because of their race. And when I look at my brother or anybody who has a disability, I think, well, they're different than me. And I'm okay with saying that. Some people aren't and find that quite offensive. But I think that if I look at my brother and think, well, he's just like me, then I deny him as well all these challenges that he faces in life. And I don't want to look at those challenges and dismiss them.
So was your family okay with you doing a film?
Right. So you asked that too, right? The film and the photographs. The photographs were much different.
And you're a photographer.
Yeah.
So you are just, I'm a journalist, so I've been around a lot of photographers. Photographers just always have a camera with them, and that's just part of their lives.
Yeah, the difference between the camera, the still camera, and the video camera is that if we're spending time together and I bring the camera up to my eye and I make a picture, I put the camera down. And so this moment of capturing is rather quick. But if I'm taking video of you, I'm locked onto you. And then I'm also trying to visually build a scene. And so it's more comprehensive. And when I had met the folks at MediaStorm and decided we were going to do this, first I asked my family, are you up for this? This is the work that they do. And it's going to be different because it's not just going to be me with a camera. Other people are going to show up. They're going to be taking, video. They're going to be gathering audio. There's going to be more
people. It's going to be invasive.
Extremely invasive. And so in the very beginning, they didn't quite understand what that was going to be like because they had no experience prior to that. And so up front, they were fine. And then as this dragged out, it became much more difficult for them. MediaStorm wanted to do an interview with my parents, and they pushed back on it quite a bit at that time. They didn't want to talk, and when you have that camera on you that is just continually rolling, you feel like you're under a microscope. If I make this one click, that's just a photograph. But when the camera is rolling and collecting video and audio, everything is there. And where a photograph is silent, and there's a beauty in that, and there's also a danger in that, because you can look at a photograph and
make assumptions about things,
complete in ridiculous assumptions, right? And based on your ideas of what you're looking at and your preconceived notions, with the video camera, somebody was looking and listening to everything they were doing. It wasn't just click one moment.
I wonder if we can play a little clip. That this focuses, as you mentioned, there's a lot of conflict between your brother's desire for independence in the film mm-hmm. and his need for support and safety. And this is actually you talking. I wonder if we can play a clip of that.
My brother is well enough to look at the world around him and understand what he's missing. He gets it. But he's not capable of understanding how to do things to get what he wants. He won't look at himself and see himself for who he really is. That is a failure on his part, but that comes from his experiences growing up. You can do anything, Nick. Bull. Like, how can you do that to somebody?
That's a clip of our guest, Chris Capozzello, talking about his brother Nick in the film The Distance Between Us, and Chris is in studio with me. Chris, I think that captures a lot of the tension, right? Not just between you, I think you're kind of this, in some ways you're an observer of this because you're not living in your parents' house with him, but then, so you kind of, I think captures a lot of the complicated feelings around the relationship between you and your brother, between your brother and your parents. What was it like for your family, I wonder, when they saw all of this?
So there was a tremendous amount of tension surrounding Nick moving out. And I wasn't silent about my feelings about that. So they already knew how I felt. And I said, I will speak candidly when I'm interviewed by MediaStorm.
Because at this point, your brother is, he's 30.
We were 35.
You were 35.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, my gripe was that he wasn't prepared to move out, that it wasn't safe for him to move out. I think it was worth taking a risk so that Nick could live a fuller life.
But you were real. I mean, you can see it in your face in the film, how worried you are.
Yeah. And I'm still worried about my brother. And he's making it. He's still on his own. But he's not safe. And when we talk about, when I mentioned before about cognitive issues, when you and I, the difference between you and I and my brother would be that when we go to cross the street and we're at a crosswalk, we have the right to walk, right? But we should look both ways and not walk in front of a car. A month and a half ago, Nick came to a crosswalk and just went. And he got hit by a car. Mm. But he thinks he can, and he was upset. He was angry at the person driving the car. And the person driving the car had no time to stop before they hit him. So those are the things that scare me. They still scare me. And I'm waiting for the call when, you know, I mean, the Milford Police Department called me because I was in emergency contact for him and said, your brother has been hit by a car. So, you know, there's tension in the experiences that I have with my brother are far different than my parents. They have an adult child living with them for most, you know, their entire adult lives. And whether it's selfish or not, you know, they didn't want to give up their golden years. And part of it is that Nick is difficult. You know, when we look at people with disabilities, we often sentimentalize them, right? We think that, you know, I think we subconsciously think that sickness and disability beget virtue. Well, Nick is a human being just like you and me, and he's not always the nicest of people. And I don't know you. I think you're pretty great. We've met a couple of times, but I'm pretty sure you can be a jerk. Because you're a human
especially
being.
Especially to our siblings.
Yeah. I mean, right? Yeah, you're a human being. I'm a human being. And we're connected in that way. And so the hard part is that, you know, I say without having the experience of my parents that that's selfish for you to do that. And part of me, you know, thinks that it's selfish because he's also not been prepared. And that is that's the scariest thing. I think that. And he's making it now. So, you know, maybe I've been proven wrong in this whole scenario, but is he safe? And so I want Nick to be on his own. I want him, but I want him to be safe. And, you know, in his experience living on his own, he had me over for dinner and he was putting something in the oven and I watched him fall into the oven and I'm there and I'm watching it, but I'm too far away and I can't save him. And so he burns himself and he had burns all over his hands. And, you know, so on one hand, he's making it. On the other hand, he's also not completely safe.
That's photojournalist Chris Capozzello. Chris, thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you, Nyla.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. In 2016 and throughout the beginning of 2017, thousands gathered in North Dakota to protest the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. Many people from the Standing Rock Indian Reservation consider the pipeline a threat to clean water and to sacred land. Led by Native communities, the camps at the pipeline site grew to thousands and became a center for resistance and cultural preservation. Michigan photographer Levi Rickert was also there. He's the publisher and editor of Native News Online, and his photos were featured as part of a Chicago exhibit at the American Indian Center. It was called Standing Rock, Photos of an Indigenous Movement. I spoke with Levi last fall, and I asked him what it was like to be documenting this movement at the time.
Well, I think that Standing Rock is like was an event that really gave impetus for a new generation of American Indians to be involved. Many of us who grew up in the 70s remember Wounded Knee when the American Indian Movement took over that hamlet out in South Dakota on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. But Standing Rock really provided a means for contemporary Native kids and young adults to really participate in the movement.
And what was the atmosphere like, Levi? Because I think for people like myself who weren't there and watching news reports, I think we always get a limited snapshot of what happened.
The, electrifying is actually the word that came to my mind as you asked that question. It was very electrifying for me. I'm a Potawatomi Native person. I live in Michigan, and I publish and edit Native News Online. However, as both as a reporter and as an American Indian, I was very, very proud of what the what fellow tribal people were doing from across Indian country.
And I wonder, as a journalist, how you were able to navigate that. Obviously, you're familiar with having to build trust in the people that you talk to. And with a project that was so intimate, I wonder how you cultivated those relationships in what was sometimes a tense situation.
Well, I think, I was on the front line, so to speak. We had gone to this bridge that was closed down, and I remember in particular one day there were fellow journalists from the New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, other places that were there. And some of the people who were kind of monitoring what the journalists were up to, I guess maybe part of the security detail out there, they saw my name badge with the logo in. Clearly, they recognize Native News Online, and some cases, one case, for instance, they said, come along with me, and they allowed me to get a little closer to the action. So I think it was one of those things where it was very fulfilling for me as a journalist, because I was proud to be part of it and be able to really give my perspective on it. And I think that Native journalists tend to give a little bit of a perspective than the mainstream media. Albeit many of the several of the journalists from mainstream media stopped me and actually asked me questions about it so they could understand the situation a little better. So I was proud to be part of that process as well.
Right. And I imagine there was a lot of, I don't know if cultural translation is the right word, but for, as you're talking about how electrifying it was, and when you're talking about how this was a movement that was really created, how were you able to capture that in the photographs that you chose? Because I imagine you probably took a lot of photographs while you were there, right?
Actually, I took a library after Standing Rock was somewhat finished, although we would probably argue the movement continues, but I had like 1,600 photographs of
wow.
in my library for Native News Online. And what happened was I was able to team up with the Grand Valley State University here, and I'm on the Native American Advisory Board. And so the Office of Coochie Local History, I'm also on that board, they offered to give me an intern. And last summer, we actually went through the process of just narrowing them down to 100 photos into what are actually 53 photographs. So it was a long process, and it's like, where do you cut? Because there were really some really, I thought, some real vivid photos that were real compelling that kind of tell the story. And what we've tried to do with this exhibition is not simply just put the photographs up, but actually there's a narrative, which I will say, as a journalist, what's the line? Well, journalists, we tell the first draft
of history. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and what happened was, by the time I wrote the narrative for the exhibition, it was maybe 6 to 9 months removed, depending on the situation, and I was able to be a little more reflective and give it a little different, how can I say, maybe updated some of the original stories, because as I was writing the narrative, I went back to the original stories that Native News Online published at the time, but then I had a different perspective. So it was really an interesting process for me as a journalist.
I'm speaking with Levi Rickert. Levi, I tweeted out one of the pictures that you sent us ahead of time for me to look at, and it's this amazing image of all of the encampment, and you can just get a sense of the amount of people that were there. Is that one of your favorite photographs? Can you tell us a little bit more about the picture?
I didn't see the one you tweeted. Is it the one that has
It's the one with the love.
Love.
So it, yes.
Okay. I have to say it's one of my personal favorites because, quite frankly, the local media at the time was putting out stories in North Dakota that, you know, these American Indians were a bunch of agitators from outside of the state of North Dakota, albeit tribes from across the country participated. But they really tried to give the spin that a bunch of them were nothing more than militant criminals, mob people that just wanted to go in and create a lot of chaos. And what I saw when I was there was quite the opposite. It was a bunch of people, Native people, who came to really lend their support to a cause that's very important to all of us, Native and non-Natives, the environment. And the word love on that banner just really caught my attention. I think it's one of my favorite because I think the world needs a lot more love than hate. And these days, we could use a lot of love.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would agree with that, Levi. A big part of the collection of the photos, also to your point about non-Natives, there was a significant veteran presence, military veterans who were at Standing Rock. Why was highlighting that relationship so important to you?
Well, I think that, you know, from a historic perspective, American Indians have participated on a percentage basis at a higher level than non-Natives in the U.S. military. And the idea that non-Native veterans came to lend support was pretty, I think, pretty astounding. And there again, to dispel the myth that these were a bunch of just radical militant people out at Standing Rock is quite contrary to what I saw up there. The veterans coming together, and I remember one Saturday night there was this massive rally with the veterans, and it was quite remarkable to listen to people one after the other come up and say why they were there, lending the support, and here comes that word love, the love that was flowing in the room, just the idea that it was whether you were American Indian or non-Native, there was a lot of love in the room, and the idea that the veterans came to support was pretty monumental as far as I'm concerned.
We're talking with Levi Rickard and the pictures that he made at Standing Rock. And we've got Dave Spencer with the American Indian Center on the line with us as well. Hi, Dave. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Nyla. Thanks for having me.
I wonder if you can tell us how Levi's work fits in with the mission of the work that you all are doing at the American Indian Center.
Yeah, it's pretty organic. Well, at the Indian Center, our exhibition space is dedicated to Native First Voice. So we feel that our space is the only space in the city of Chicago that's 100% Native voice. And when it comes to issues like Standing Rock and what Levi has accomplished, it fits in perfectly because, again, it's our perspective. It's our way to tell our story how we want. And this, and you know, you have the visual, but then it's also the text, and it's also Levi coming and presenting his experience, and that's really important to us to use this space to tell those intergenerational stories.
And Levi, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this next question I'm going to ask Dave as well. As I mentioned, this was a couple of years ago. The pipeline did get built. I wonder if that changes how you all look at the photographs or the reason why you wanted to have the exhibition, Dave?
Well, you know, it's one of those things where media outlets, non-Native media outlets, you know, they get an opportunity to tell their impressions of what we're trying to accomplish. And one of the things that at least I've seen in the Native news outlets, especially Levi's, is that, you know, this isn't just a Native problem. It's a human problem. And I think that's what media kind of lacks in its presenting our issues to the masses, is that, you know, we're looking out for ourselves, sure, but also, you know, it's all about community. And that when I say community, I'm not talking internal, I'm talking external, the larger community as well, because it's going to affect all of us. So I think with these stories and these exhibits, people get a chance to see how, you know, we want to protect the earth for the good of humanity.
Levi?
Well, I think that from the perspective of the community, I think it's so important that I'm really proud as the publisher editor of Native News Online, to have it at the Chicago Indian Center. It's one of the oldest urban Indian agencies in the United States. I think the overall goal, I think, of the exhibition is really to provide space for American Indians to share their narrative, who we are, that we still exist, and that it helps to bring, I'm hoping that the exhibition helps to bring recognition there are current issues beyond the pipeline there at the Missouri River, at Standing Rock, but like in Michigan, the Straits of Mackinac, where the Enbridge Line 5 is outdated. It would be extremely catastrophic if the line bursts. So the fight continues, the struggles continue.
In Michigan.
Talk about climate change, the environment. And, you know, sometimes it appears now in Washington, with talk of deregulation and lessening of some of the Obama administration's EPA standards, I really think it's critical that we keep it to the forefront, that people understand this is real, climate change is real. If we don't do something quickly, you know, it could really be catastrophic for us in 10 to 15 years, as the report came out last week. And as a Native person, we like to jokingly say we have always been the first environmentalists. I think the exhibition helps really establish that point.
That was Dave Spencer, Development and Arts Coordinator for the American Indian Center. I was also speaking with photographer Levi Rickert. He's also the publisher and editor of Native News Online. Does it for us today. You can follow us on Twitter. Our handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. We're also on Facebook. If you want to search there for the 21st, you can like us, and it's another way to comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, if you want to leave us a voicemail as well, send us an email, or remember our social media handles, all you have to remember is our website. That's 21stshow.org. We've also got all of our past shows archived there. You can find us also most places you get your podcasts. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, NPR One. Search for The 21ST. We're produced by Libby Foster, Anna Casey, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.